You are listening to Counterterrorism After 9/11, a podcast series by the International Center for Counterterrorism, exploring how our field has changed in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. Today, Counterterrorism After 9/11 is speaking to Hina Shamsi, director of the ACLU's National Security Project. With a career spent protecting civil liberties and human rights within a framework of national security, Hina will be discussing how her work intersects with counterterrorism, as well as providing insight into how these elements have changed over the past 20 years. Interviewing her is Dr. Rimyana Van Ark, a research fellow and coordinator at the International Center for Counterterrorism.
It is a pleasure to be joined today by Hina Shamsi, the director of the ACLU National Security Project. Hina, our listeners and readers will undoubtedly be very familiar with your name and your work, but could you briefly introduce yourself, your role within ACLU, and perhaps a little bit about your professional background?
Of course. First of all, let me begin by thanking you so much for having me. It's my great pleasure. My name is Hina Shamsi, and I am the director of the ACLU's National Security Project. And my colleagues and I, we seek to ensure that U.S. national security policies and practices abide by the Constitution, human rights, and the United States obligations under law, which, as you can imagine, has been something of a challenge over the last 20 years.
Thank you very much. And I would like to start with a little bit before 9/11. The 20th anniversary of 9/11, in parallel with the heartbreaking scenes and events in Afghanistan, has triggered many reflections on the day itself and on the legacies and aftermath of the day. But before we delve into this post-9/11 world of security and counterterrorism, I would like to ask you for your thoughts on the pre-9/11 trajectories of national security, of counterterrorism, of human rights, and of civil liberties.
Of course. And maybe I can start with a response to one of the other questions that you asked me, which is that, you know, this is not ever an area on which I thought I would work. As a young person growing up, I grew up outside of the United States. I grew up in Hong Kong and different parts of Southern Africa, and originally from Pakistan, South Asia. So I always thought, you know, I always wanted a career in human rights, but I thought it would be based on gender or refugee issues in the parts of the world that I'd grown up. And growing up outside the United States, you know, I knew that the U.S. had never been perfect on human rights issues, far from it. Often the U.S. had supported regimes that were carrying out human rights violations, or certainly was plagued by its own domestic issues, so many of which are the consequence of enslavement and what the country did to indigenous populations. It's never fully addressed those issues properly. But I always thought that the U.S. presented something of a it was important that the U.S. said the right things on the world stage, even if it wasn't always doing the right things. There are very few countries, in fact, you know, not that I would any that I would say is absolutely perfect. And so for me growing up, it was a, you know, how do we work towards equality, dignity, and justice for people in our various different communities as part of a global community, you know, very impacted by my study of and commitment to the human rights regime and how it developed in the post-World War II era. And so fast forward to, you know, the era right before 9/11, and in this country, you know, in the United States, we go through paroxysms, I think, of responses and overreactions to real and perceived threats. rights, and this country then has a history of suppressing human rights and civil liberties, including domestically, only to come to regret it. And that period before 9/11 seemed to be, you know, one of a focus on what was happening abroad. You know, there'd been the war in Iraq in an earlier period, but the attention also seemed to be a lot more inward. And a lot of the excesses of the Vietnam War, excesses, I mean, that's a euphemism, rights violations of the Vietnam War era, Cambodia, civil rights era, had to some extent at least been attempted to be corrected in law, infrastructure, and policy. And there were movements domestically towards equality. The summer before 9/11, Congress was poised to pass the End Racial Profiling Act, you know, banning bias-based discrimination in law enforcement. So the trajectory seemed to be by no means perfect, significant problems, but not what we then came to see in the 9/11 era.
Indeed, it seems to be very much a Rubicon that we've crossed without coming back. And for many, the events of that day are very vivid and very distinctive memories still. For many, it prompted a really big change in personal and career paths. And we have already heard from other participants in the podcast series that it's linked to some very, very personal experiences on the day too. How did you experience the day? What is your most vivid memory of the day? And has that driven you forward in your work 20 years on?
There are memories. I have memories of the day that are indelible, and memories that are just part of what came in the most immediate aftermath. I was a young lawyer, and my office, the building I worked in, was opposite the World Trade Center. And so, I mean, I'm, you know, not going to get into this, but just it was shock, it was horror, it was deep concern for colleagues going through the subway, you know, just a lot of, I think, shared trauma on the streets, and then a lot of acts of resilience and heroism that you could see around you, and then just such a desire. I mean, I remember people were lining up to give blood until we found out that there was no blood that was really needed. You know, just such a desire to mark what had happened. And for me also, especially in the immediate aftermath, as a brown Muslim woman, and then, you know, later an immigrant to this country, a fear of what the reaction would be, because I am a student of American history as well, and was at that time. And so, you know, I remember a sense of relief, sort of filled also with great trepidation, when a few days after the attack, President Bush went to an Islamic center and said, you know, that the foundations of this country couldn't be shaken, and only the people who were responsible were actually responsible. And I think where my career went after has everything to do with what was actually then happening, which is that even as President Bush was saying those things, you know, a response was being put in place and planned that very soon after that resulted in a policy of state-sanctioned torture that was primarily carried out against brown, black, and Muslim men, led to Guantanamo, black sites, but also just domestically, you know, targeting of people for surveillance, suspicion, deportation, based on religion and national origin. And so there was a lot of something that really came to mark the subsequent years, which was policymakers having a fear-based response, which, to, you know, we're all human beings and can understand that, but that resulted in a fear-mongering response also. And that caused devastating harm to this country, and especially people of color in this country and Muslims, but the same or similar approaches causing devastating harm abroad. And that for me, but also for so many of my colleagues, both at the ACLU and the human rights community, has come to define our work and our, I guess, our generation.
Indeed. And there's quite a few important themes to touch on a little bit more. But I want to start with the note that you ended on, that post 9/11, it is almost a misnomer to reflect on national security when counterterrorism policies and measures have such a transnational impact and continue to have this transnational impact. What are your thoughts on this transformation, and in particular on this intertwining that you've implied between immigration measures and counterterrorism measures, national security measures, criminal justice measures? In many respects, the border has really become a defining feature, and immigration policies have come to define this new phase of counterterrorism post 9/11.
You're asking such a good question and a complex question. And at the very real risk of oversimplifying, I want to sort of pull out a theme that is embedded in your question, which is, in the name of national security, United States security, the response of the last 20 years has largely been marked by this approach in which the U.S. claims adherence to human rights and universal values and domestic values, even as, in the name of national security, it has violated human rights. And, you know, when we're talking about immigration and the border, you know, a lot of those things are embedded in fundamental human rights. The right to refuge, asylum, the right against discrimination on the base of race, religion, national origin, and the right to due process, equality. You know, if your liberty or other sort of fundamental human rights are to be deprived, it should only be, they cannot be deprived without due process of law, right? And in area after area, the constraints and safeguards that the human rights system put in place and sought to put in place, and really also that in many ways are supposed to be mapped onto or consonant with the U.S. Constitution, those were cast aside or violated. And that's part of a trajectory that we saw continuing through the Bush administration, obviously, in many, many ways through the Obama administration, and then through the Trump administration, the veneer of norms and safe policy safeguards and constraints that had been put on lens of you know, authority was cast aside, you know. And so to give just one example, you know, I remember how heartened I was after Trump imposed the Muslim ban to see people streaming to the airports and saying, you know, of Muslims, let them in. That's something I did not think I would expect to see in my lifetime. But even then, it reminded me of the original Muslim registry in the post 9/11 era under George W. Bush, which required special registration of young, primarily young Muslim boys and men, and immigrants and visitors, and the tearing apart of families. So, you know, and then later on, our Supreme Court after multiple legal fights, upheld a very pernicious version of the Muslim ban. So, that, you know, to go back to your question, in the name of national security, a lot of these harms and devastations and violations of law and displacement of rule of law, but it is also, here's one of the things that's sort of different about this era, which is, you know, I really hate the term global war on terror, war on terror. You know, it's very much the Bush administration's frame. But part of what continues with that rhetoric is a claim that in the name of what must and should be understood as exceptional, which is war, right, the U.S. can claim war-based authorities, states of emergency, in order to engage in actions that are outside of war and are grounded in militarization, violence, and racial injustices.
Yeah, and I think we can say that the argument, very often used argument that I'm not particularly fond of, this balance and this balancing exercise between human rights and security has been used as a justification a lot, when in reality, the balance is not really a balance, and it's very much shifting the scales deliberately in one direction and pretending respect for the other side. And you've already mentioned resilience, resistance as themes. How do you feel that human rights, civil liberties have resisted this push, this balancing exercise, if we were to call it that? Do you see them having been to have been very resilient? Do we think that they have resisted enough? Is there a lot of work still to be done?
Such a great question. And so, like you, I tend to resist the notion of balance, right? This idea that on the scales, if one thing goes up, the other thing has to go down, right? And that's positing an opposition between rights and security, where I think rights and security have got to go hand in hand. And that's not just words, it is in action, right? Which means things like, if you impose, for example, security measures abroad or lethal strikes in fragile conflict-ridden states, instead of the necessary work of showing a respect for human rights in communities where states are fragile, human rights defenders are working so hard to advance communities' interest, looking for a multi-pronged approach, then the balance over the last 20 years has always tilted, right? It's actually got to go hand in hand instead. And I think, so there's a lot of work that's been done and a lot of work I think that needs to be done, because in many ways, I had not anticipated quite how far the United States would go 20 years later. I hadn't anticipated even 15 years later. And, you know, but I think thanks to the work of impacted communities, of independent media, of rights advocates and allies, some of the worst abuses have come to light and ended, right? So systemic torture, that torture program, it took a while to end it, but by the end of the Bush administration, we had ended it. Work still remains to be done in order to address the torture is always like a cancer or a corruption, right? It permeates systems. Torture is currently still permeating the failure to end indefinite detention and unfair trials at Guantanamo. But that did come to an end, right? The special registration of Muslims, it lasted 10 years in one form or another. But by the Obama administration, when it was clear that the Trump administration was on the horizon, thanks to the work of rights advocates and impacted communities, the Obama administration took the legal and policy infrastructure that still remained on the books off the books. Another thing that we've worked on, which is the NSA's mass surveillance and collection of virtually every American's call records, that's also ended. So when we work together through highlighting the issues, bringing them to light, court cases combined with advocacy for oversight abroad and domestically, we're able to bring those things to an end. And I think that resilience, for me, you know, it is so necessary to keep going. And in order to keep going, I have to have hope. And so I find hope when I look around and see actions such as the racial justice protests last summer here in the United States, right? Those were due to the years-long work of Black organizers and communities then coming out in response to the tipping point of the horrific tragedy of the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and far too many other Black men and women. And that led to a movement on the streets in the United States, but also in the rest of the world, which I was so heartened to see was drawing the connections between militarization at home and militarization abroad. The connections between seeing communities of color as a security threat at home, which no one questions anymore, right? Security threat lens, to what that means abroad. And you know, those connections are there whether we talk about you know, prevention approaches, countering violent extremism programs, both here in the United States and those similar kinds of programs abroad that tear apart communities. And for me, it is about the resilience of perseverance of young people who are saying, no, no more, not in our name. We've grown up under this and we don't want this and we want change. And then the specific means and measures to take down this policy infrastructure that still remains in place in order to move towards what resilience and a commitment to fairness and justice and human rights can bring to us.
And I have to admit, with the scenes in Afghanistan really fresh in everyone's mind, it's really important to talk about hope. And it's really important to talk about the really hard, positive work that has been done to challenge so many of the injustices and horrors of counterterrorism policies and national security policies over the last 20 years. And before we talk a little bit more about hope and what perhaps has been positive lessons learned, what are the biggest challenges that still remain in relation to counterterrorism, do you think, 20 years on?
So in terms of challenges, I'm going to pick up where you left off with Afghanistan. You know, we're talking about hope and it's necessary. Afghanistan, to me, is about the resilience and efforts of Afghan people and Afghan women and Afghan human rights defenders and leaders who've been at the forefront of the work for their own communities and for whom, you know, so much more needs to be done shoulder to shoulder with them. And it's hard for me, and I wouldn't presume to tell people in very different situations about how they should have hope as opposed to wanting to learn from them about what they would want. One aspect of, I think, what you know, I work on is, along with other colleagues, is the impact of US lethal strikes. And in, you know, I look to the tremendous work that has been done by the Afghan Human Rights Commission and other leaders in Afghanistan, essentially saying that part of the reason that they are where they are today is because the U.S. was carrying out lethal strikes in the context of recognized war there that had a devastating impact on civilians with impunity, without meaningful accountability. And that's part of the legacy that my country has left. And now we're hearing talk of so-called over-the-horizon strikes, even in the wake of the terrible, terrible, wrongful strike in Afghanistan, in Kabul, on August 29th. And to me, over-the-horizon is like using enhanced interrogation to talk about torture, right? This, you know, if those kinds of strikes continue, it is a continuation of, and this goes back to your question, of a program of lethal strikes outside of recognized armed conflict. You know, the US is saying that it's withdrawing from Afghanistan, so that's presumably where we should be heading. But this is a program that has devastated communities in multiple parts of the world, from Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, to name just a few. And so that is one of the things that I think we absolutely have got to end. It fuels displacement and instability. It is a tactic, not a strategy. And for too long, this country has, and this is another theme, put its own national security and those of its putative allies above those of communities in which it acts. So that's one area that I think we really need to do work. Another is, we really have to end indefinite detention, unfair trials at Guantanamo. That may have not been at the forefront of many people's minds, but it remains that the United States is continuing to detain 39 people, men, and subject them to human rights abuses in that context. And you can't put the post 9/11 era behind you without putting an end to that. Another thing that I think is so critically important, and this is goes back to the themes, is domestically, because and this will have an impact on sort of what the US does abroad as well. One of the things that is fueling so many harms is that in 2014, 2015, under the Obama administration, our Departments of Justice and Homeland Security passed what's called guidance on race. And it purported to ban bias-based racial profiling on the basis of race, religion, national origin, but carved out gaping loopholes for national security in the border, in essence, permitting that bias. And that, as a matter of structure and policy, has then infused watchlisting systems, state and local and border practices. So, that's one of the things that have got to end in order to be able to start addressing the structural issues of racial injustice. And then another thing that we're very focused on is reining in mass surveillance and putting an end to privacy violating policies and practices, both domestically and abroad, because so many of these things go to the fundamental architecture that has been left in place that we want to work to dismantle.
Thank you so much for that answer. And indeed, I think it's very alluring 20 years on to try to think 20 years have passed. A lot of legislation has come, gone, been dismantled or changed. Our feeling as society and societies perhaps towards 9/11 has changed for many people, doesn't feel as raw and as present as it used to be. But the reality is that we really have not moved away from it as much as we would like to hope and as much as we would like to think. And there's still quite a lot that remains to be done. And as a last question, if I may, what is the biggest lesson that we have learned from 9/11? There are many. I think some very, very negative. And as you stressed, we need to continue working on dismantling some of those legacies and some of those lessons. But what would be one of the biggest ones or the biggest ones that we have learned? And where do we go forward in terms of thinking about it for the next 20 years?
You're asking an excellent question and a hard one because there are so many. I think for me personally, it is that it's really been a year of reflection, as well as the work 2021. And so I thought it would be bad, the response to 9/11. I did not know how bad it would be and how long it would take to dismantle it. But for me, the biggest lesson has been to, even as we work together on the different pieces that we may individually work on, a recognition of how our fates are intrinsically tied to each other, and that the response has to be seen and understood as being one that feeds on fear-mongering approaches when of each other, you know, in an era of rising authoritarianism and populism. And it is at that time and in these times that we must continue to insist on equality and dignity and fundamental rights for ourselves and each other. And that may just sound very, I don't know, okay or naive, but it really keeps bringing me back to fundamentals when I feel like I'm getting too tied up in the legalese or the policy arguments. It really is a, how do we work on this together? How do we advance a more just, rights promoting future? And that's what I keep coming back to.
And I think that this is a wonderful food for thought, pause for reflection, and a big challenge for the next 20 years. How do we come back to this, and how does human dignity resist what we could call security populism? I think in many respects, having learned to live with it over the course of the last 20 years, I would really like to thank Hina on behalf of our readers and our listeners for having the time for us today and for sharing her thoughts and reflections on the last 20 years. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you with us. And hopefully we'll continue these conversations and this work in the future. And for now, this is it.
Thank you so much for having me again.
This has been Counterterrorism After 9/11, a new podcast series from the International Center for Counterterrorism. For more insight, find us at icct.nl. Stay tuned for more episodes of Counterterrorism After 9/11.